The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine, North Carolina History for Students. I'm going to be reading today from Volume 61, Number 1, the Fall 2021 issue, Resilience, Tar Heels, Tragedies, and Triumphs, produced by the North Carolina Museum of History. The first article is From Posters to Photographs, How Objects Show North Carolinians' Experience in World War II by Matthew M. Peake. Matthew M. Peake is the Military Collection Archivist, State Archives of North Carolina. Peake holds a B.A. in History from Kentucky Christian University and a dual M.A. in American History, Public History, Archival Studies from Wright State University. Peake has worked as an archivist in Ohio, Kentucky, Montana, and North Carolina. He has worked at the State Archives of North Carolina since 2014. I work as an archivist. That's a person who becomes an expert in preserving original historic materials kept and used by people in the past and present, such as letters, photographs, maps, old films, diaries, posters, and other everyday items. Archivists work to arrange, describe, and make these artifacts available so people can see and touch the past in person. As an archivist, my main job is not to tell stories. I work to preserve the experiences of military veterans and those on the home front, and the connections those experiences have with their physical materials. A diary carried all through Europe in World War II in a coat pocket. A letter with a lipstick kiss from a sweetheart. Or a map with handwritten notations on it used for a major military operation. The objects tell their own stories as long as they are saved and preserved for future generations. These items speak to struggles, survival, and resilience in trying times that many North Carolinians thought would never end. Yet they either came through the tough times or are remembered for their fight in the face of adversity. I would like to show you what I mean by spotlighting several collections of historic materials held by the military collection at the State Archives. Let's see how the items connect to the resilience of the people who used and created them in times of war. Most wars have a start and end point. I like to look at how people involved in military service were affected and changed from the start of the war to its end. Some of these individuals do not have happy outcomes, and many do not survive war. Those who do make it through are forever affected by their experiences in it, and it guides their post-war lives. Attack at Pearl Harbor. The United States entered military action in World War II on December 7, 1941, when the Imperial Japanese Navy Air Service launched a sneak attack on the United States Naval Base at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. It was a quiet Sunday morning, and Weldon C. Burleson from Yancey County was there at Hickam Field when Japanese aircraft began bombing and shooting buildings, planes, and people on the ground. Burleson died in the attack, becoming one of the first North Carolinians to die during World War II. What survives of original items created by Burleson is a postcard, the last known correspondence he sent before his death to his friend Elsie Edward and her husband Ed. The two grew up together in Yancey County, but the Edwardses moved to New Jersey during the war. On the postcard, he asked Elsie to give his address to some of her female friends. He hoped some would write to help keep his spirits up during his military service. The postcard is evidence of happy times for Burleson before the war changed everything. Photographing the war. One North Carolina man who served throughout World War II was Guy O. Cox of Wilson. A photographer for local newspapers before the war, he enlisted in the U.S. Navy on June 13, 1942. Cox went through photographer's training at the U.S. Naval School of Photography at the U.S. Naval Air Station in Pensacola, Florida in 1942. He was appointed as a photographer's mate to the USS Bunker Hill, CV-17, when it was commissioned on May 25, 1943. The carrier served in the Pacific Theater from late 1943 through May 1945. Cox documented life aboard the ship, including the activities and service of the men. After the war, he became a longtime beloved photographer, taking photographs of generations of North Carolinians in Wilson County. Despite some of the tough times he saw in service, the training and experience he received during World War II gave him the skills to thrive after the war. Women on the home front. World War II was a challenge not just for those in the military, but also for those back home on the home front, particularly women. Society had strict standards about how women should behave, what jobs they could do, and what education they could have. Most women worked at home as wives and mothers, taking care of their families. But that began to change as men were drafted for active military service. That left shortages in the number of men able to work for businesses and in local government positions. Women were needed to fill those jobs. Women also struggled with having romantic relationships during these changing times. Many women were left home alone to struggle with supporting family members, working long shifts at wartime production factories, and dealing with rising prices. The changing roles of women in society meant a lot of women found a new independence to be themselves and to control their own lives and careers. One such woman was Geraldine Mayo of Pamlico County. She had studied to become a teacher of home economics and science education at what is now East Carolina University in Greenville, graduating with a bachelor's degree in 1939. During World War II, Mayo became a vocational home economics teacher at Lee Woodward Public Schools in the town of Black Creek, south of Wilson. Mayo was very involved with her career, her community, and her students. The last thing she wanted was to fall in love with a man in the military. However, sometime around mid to late 1944, Mayo met United States Coast Guard Reserve Officer David L. Beveridge of Beaufort. David Beveridge came from a sailing family, and he joined the Coast Guard Reserve on June 6, 1942. He would be stationed from 1944 to 1945 at Fort Macon in Norfolk, Virginia. As of November 1944, he was chief boatswain's mate at the Dead Rise cruiser CGR-1261 stationed at Fort Macon. Soon David decided he wanted to propose to Geraldine, but her parents did not think they had known each other long enough. In the meantime, the two wrote letters to each other to stay in touch. Geraldine taught herself Morse code, which was the communication system using dots and dashes to send messages by telegraph. Think of a wire-based version of email. Then he used it to write short coded messages on the back of the envelopes of the letters she'd sent him. To read them, David had to write out the letters for each set of dots and dashes. Geraldine and David wed on June 15, 1945, in her hometown of Bear Creek while David was still in the Coast Guard. After the war, Geraldine became a teacher at Beaufort High School, and David became a ferry boat captain of the Ocracoke Island to Cedar Island Ferry. They were married for 32 years before David passed away. Geraldine Beveridge still had her career and independence, showing that women could have it all during World War II, despite the challenges in the world and society. Kids on the home front. Children in North Carolina also faced challenges during World War II. Often one parent was away serving in the U.S. Armed Forces, while the parent remaining at home had to work or support home front war efforts like war bond drives. Many children were sent to live with aunts, uncles, grandparents, or other relatives during the war. School became one place where children had support from friends and teachers. There, many became involved in school wartime classes and programs. Students collected scrap metal or other materials to be used to manufacture items needed for the military. Many children sold war bonds and war saving stamps, which raised money for the U.S. government to fund the war. As part of these school wartime programs, many young people created posters on topics related to the war. One such poster was drawn by student Elizabeth Baker, an eighth grader in the Wotton School in Winston-Salem. The poster features a young person wearing a patriotic Uncle Sam hat and promoting the purchase of war saving stamps to support the war effort. Children all over North Carolina made drawings and paintings for posters like these. Integration of the military. World War II showed the resilience of black North Carolinians who were still forced to use segregated facilities, face daily racism, and endure war and financial hardships. Many hoped that if they volunteered to serve their country, it would push America to integrate white and black service individuals in the U.S. Armed Forces. However, the great majority of black Americans entering military service were forced into segregated units, with white officers commanding them. These black men and women were given some of the worst living and service conditions in the war. One man who chose to fight through this was the Reverend Elmer P. Gibson of Greensboro, and later Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Gibson was the son of another reverend, Lewis B. Gibson, who had been born into slavery in 1835. Elmer Gibson went on to earn a degree at Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, where he became friends with African-American poet Langston Hughes. Gibson earned a Bachelor of Divinity degree in 1930 at Crozer Theological Seminary in Pennsylvania, becoming the first black graduate of the seminary that Martin Luther King Jr. would later attend. Gibson would fight racism within the Methodist Church Conference in which he served as a minister from 1929 through 1941. Gibson was called into active military service in the U.S. Army, commissioned as a first lieutenant in the Chaplain Corps on February 10, 1941. Due to age restrictions and racism, Gibson was not allowed to serve as an officer in the regular Army. Instead, he was given an officer's rank in the reserves despite his serving in an active Army unit. Captain Gibson became the chaplain for the segregated 364th Infantry Regiment, colored, 92nd Infantry Division, U.S. Army, which was sent in 1943 to be stationed on the remote and cold Adak Island in the Aleutian Islands, Alaska. The U.S. government was worried about a Japanese attack on these islands, which did happen at one point. Segregated black units were often sent to be stationed in isolation from white units or in some of the worst living conditions overseas. At the time, chapel services for Army units were segregated. However, Chaplain Gibson was a longtime proponent for the end of segregation. He took advantage of several opportunities, the isolated island, the limited number of men stationed there, and his status as island chaplain for both white and black U.S. military units, to do something dramatic. He introduced integrated chapel services. This makes Elmer Gibson one of the earliest military officers to attempt some level of integration of regular, combat-ready white and black service individuals in the U.S. Army. For his dedicated service as a chaplain and his service to all the troops regardless of color, Elmer Gibson was awarded the Legion of Merit Award. At the end of World War II, the U.S. Army wanted to keep Gibson as a chaplain, but would not give him rank or admittance into the regular Army, just the Army Reserves. Gibson wanted the rights that came with his service history and the role being asked of him. After some time, Gibson chose to remain a career officer in the U.S. Army, but only if he could pass an Army examination and be accepted into the regular Army. After passing his test in March 1946, Gibson was appointed to the regular U.S. Army with the permanent rank of major by President Harry S. Truman. Gibson became one of the highest-ranking African-Americans in the U.S. Army. With Gibson's appointment in 1946, President Truman chose him to be an advisor on plans to enact a complete desegregation of the U.S. Armed Forces. Gibson would continue to serve in this capacity during Truman's entire presidency, according to Gibson's family. Gibson's views and opinions were key in leading Truman to issue Executive Order 9981 in July 1948, establishing equality of treatment and opportunity in the United States military, regardless of race. Still, integration of the U.S. armed forces had to be done from the ground up, which took time. Gibson is one of the most unsung heroes for the integration of the U.S. armed forces, and his drive to persevere despite the racism he faced in World War II led to a major positive change for people of color in the United States. To learn more, follow the North Carolina Department of Natural and Cultural Resources, North Carolina Stories of Service blog. You can also follow the North Carolina Stories of Service Facebook page to see new items, images, and stories about North Carolina's veterans. Here are the captions of the photographs that accompany this article. U.S. Navy photographer Guy O. Cox of Wilson, stationed on the edge of the flight deck of the Navy aircraft carrier USS Bunker Hill, CV-17, behind a Mitchell 35mm motion picture camera shooting imagery of the ship's aircraft in 1944 during World War II. The small metal pin, manufactured in 1942, is painted in the traditional patriotic colors of red, white, and blue. Its message, "Remember Pearl Harbor," offered a way for the wearer to show support for the war effort. Back of the envelope from letter postmarked on March 21, 1945, that Geraldine Mayo sent to her boyfriend, David L. Beveridge, who was serving in the U.S. Coast Guard Reserve during World War II. Mayo used Morse code to write a secret message in blue ink, which Beveridge worked to decode. Last known piece of correspondence from Weldon C. Burleson in November 1941, before he was killed at Hickam Field on December 7, 1941. This poster was created by Elizabeth Baker, an 8th grade student at the Wharton School in Winston-Salem. Perhaps this smiling doll, dressed in uniform circa 1943, helped comfort a child whose parent was away fighting in World War II. Elmer P. Gibson, circa 1941. An integrated chapel service held in the Post Chapel on the Aleutian Islands, Alaska, on August 12, 1945, during World War II. The next article is, "If We'd Only Remember Them, We'd Be Proud." Dorothy Sproul Redford and the Somerset Homecoming of 1986, by Matt Knight, who earned his bachelor's degree in history from Old Dominion University and his master's degree in museum studies from the University of Oklahoma. He's spent more than 10 years working for state parks and museums. He currently works as a historic interpreter at Somerset Place State Historic Site in Creswell. Have you ever thought about who your ancestors were and what they were like? Ancestors are people directly related to you who died before you were born, and they are your personal connection to the past. Dorothy Sproul Redford wondered about her ancestors in January 1977 as she watched a television miniseries called Roots. Based on a book with the same name by author Alex Haley, Roots told the story of Haley's ancestors, starting with a man who lived in West Africa named Kunta Kinte. The show followed Kunta Kinte through his capture and enslavement in North America in the 1700s, and then his children's, grandchildren's, and great-grandchildren's experiences while enslaved and later free African Americans in the United States. The popular and award-winning television series inspired Redford to research her own ancestors and pass on her family's history to her daughter. While researching the Little John branch of her family, Redford discovered a man named Fred Little John. She learned that he was enslaved by a man named Josiah Collins III at a plantation called Somerset Place in Washington County. From 1785 until 1865, members of the Collins family enslaved more than 861 people and forced them to live and work at Somerset Place. Both Native Africans and African Americans worked against their will to make Somerset Place one of the largest plantations in North Carolina. After finding Fred Littlejohn, Redford did more research into the history of the enslaved community at Somerset. She published her discoveries in Somerset Homecoming, Recovering a Lost Heritage, a book co-authored with Michael Dorso. When Redford visited Somerset Place State Historic Site in the early 1800s, she noticed that African Americans living nearby had little interest in the site. At the time, site tours did not include the experiences or the perspective of the enslaved persons who had been forced to live and work there. Sensing that many people living near Somerset had ancestors who were enslaved there, Redford started reaching out to them to record their families' histories. These experiences inspired Redford to organize a family reunion for everyone whose ancestors lived at Somerset. On August 30, 1986, thousands of people gathered at Somerset Place to celebrate the reunion. Music, dancing, and goodwill filled the atmosphere. Roots author Alex Haley even paid an unexpected visit. For some who attended, the Somerset Homecoming was more than a reunion. It helped them begin the healing process. Dorothy Spruill Redford's research, as well as the Somerset Homecoming, changed how many historic sites talk about slavery. Redford became the site manager for Somerset Place State Historic Site in 1988 and spent the next 20 years working to show visitors the importance of the enslaved community there. The Somerset Homecoming also inspired other historic sites such as Colonial Williamsburg and Thomas Jefferson's Monticello to organize and host reunions for descendants of their respective enslaved communities. Redford's courage in confronting a dark chapter of our past reminds us that we owe it to our descendants to be truthful about that past. Here are the captions with the accompanying photographs. Descendants embracing one another during the Somerset Homecoming of 1986. Dorothy Spruill Redford speaking at the first Somerset Homecoming in 1986. Members of the Littlejohn family gather for a picture at the Somerset Homecoming of 1991. Several reunions took place at Somerset after the initial 1986 homecoming. Dorothy Spruill Redford's research into her family's history inspired her book Somerset Homecoming, Recovering a Lost Heritage, written with Michael Dorso. The next article is How UNCG Handled the 1918 Flu Pandemic by Alexandra McQueen, who is a Greensboro native and storyteller at heart. Formerly a journalist at CNN, McQueen now tells the incredible stories of UNC Greensboro's alumni, faculty, staff, and students who serve as the voices and future leaders of the state. This story originally appeared on uncg.edu. In early 1918, influenza made its way to North Carolina and hit what was then called State Normal and Industrial College. Of the 1,164 students enrolled for the 1918-1919 academic year, about 200 students contracted the flu. Remarkably, no students died. UNC Greensboro sophomore honors college student Abigail Knight began researching the flu pandemic's effect on State Normal and Industrial College, North Carolina State University, and UNC Chapel Hill and University archivist Aaron Larimore's Interrogating UNCG's History Honors College in fall 2019. As a nursing major with a minor in anthropology, Knight thought this subject married two of her interests, and Larimore urged her to further pursue this research. Neither Knight nor Larimore could have predicted that this research would become so relevant. Abigail's research demonstrates the continued relevance of history, says Larimore. When she first selected this research topic, we had no idea just how relevant it would be. But we can examine the past, learn from successes and mistakes, and think critically about how we can apply that knowledge to our situation today. Learn more about Knight's research in the Q&A below. How did State Normal and Industrial College handle the flu pandemic? We followed the directives of the state and modeled what other universities were doing. This was also during the time of World War I, and because we were an all-female school, we didn't have any Army training camps on campus, so State Normal responded by shutting everything down. Their version of quarantine was that no one was allowed to leave campus and no one was allowed to come onto campus. Students and faculty had to also practice social distancing, much as we're doing today. They limited the number of students that could be in one place at one time. This all proved to be pretty effective because most students at State Normal did not contract the flu. This is pretty remarkable because the other colleges I looked at were not so lucky. What were some of the biggest similarities and differences between that pandemic and our current COVID-19 pandemic? Social distancing is one of the biggest similarities. Students weren't allowed to go places or gather in groups, and just like today, their everyday social lives were disrupted. Not only did the campus shut down, but everywhere else pretty much did as well. They weren't going to church or shopping like they normally would. One of the things that surprised me during my research is that it was really hard to find letters of students who lost hope during the pandemic, even though the flu was targeting the young and healthy individuals who would not normally get sick. I'm sure some were, but it didn't really stop students from doing what they needed to do. People were still carrying on with their lives much as they could, just as we are today. For example, we continued education online, and back then they continued classes as well as they could rather than go home. One of the biggest differences was the fact that the students stayed on campus and wrote out the pandemic. Another difference was how President Julius Faust handled most of what the university went through. For example, there was an infirmary on campus with a high number of students sick. For every student and every day she was in the infirmary, President Faust would send each student's family a letter updating them on her condition. This was a personal touch I wouldn't have expected, and it was fascinating reading those letters. What is the importance of this research as it relates to our current situation? It's important to look back at the past. With every new disease, we learn a little bit more. Looking at the past and seeing what has worked and what hasn't worked can help shape what we do in the future when we face a pandemic. It's really interesting to go back and see that 100 years ago, the people who were going through this had the same fears and emotions as we do today, and they were able to get through it. It is encouraging to consider how resilient State Normal and Industrial College was. Records of students and accounts of faculty members hardly dwell on the difficult times. No matter how many class scrapbooks and personal manuscripts one might look through, one would be hard-pressed to find accounts of how the quarantine impacted the lives of students. Instead, they were writing about the bonds and friendships that they had with one another. Here are the captions with the accompanying photographs, a graph indicating the number of students in the infirmary during October 1918, one of the letters that President Julius Faust wrote to the families of State Normal students who had contracted the flu to update them on their condition, October 18, 1918. This 1918 advertisement offered advice to the public on ways to prevent catching what was then called the Spanish flu. We've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.